Young Charles Cotton was dead. The doctor couldn't deny that. His stepmother, Mary Ann Cotton, claimed the 7-year-old boy had died from gastric fever. Still, the neighbors had noticed that a few too many in the Cotton household had died by similar stomach ailments in recent months. Gossip and suspicion ran rampant through the West Auckland neighborhood in County Durham, England. Slowly, the investigators and gossips began looking into the background of 40-year-old Mary Ann. The deeper they dug, the more Mary Ann's life looked like something out of a gothic horror novel. A childhood of near abuse and near poverty, an early marriage to flee an unkind stepfather, and a long string of family members who had succumbed to the mysterious gastric fever or other curious circumstances while Mary Ann was ominously close by. In his book, Mary Ann Cotton, Her Story and Trial, researcher Arthur Appleton notes that Mary Ann Robson, born in the small English village of Low Moresley in October of 1832, did not have a happy childhood. But neither did most children born in lower-class England in the early 19th century. Mary Ann's father was ardently religious, a fierce disciplinarian of Mary Ann and her younger brother Robert, and active in the choir and activities of the local Methodist church. No doubt, his daughter feared him and his punishments. When Mary Ann was 8, her parents moved the family to the town of Merton, and her father continued working in the mines until one day, about a year after their move, when he fell down a mine shaft to an early death. As Dickens would repeatedly chronicle in his classic writings, life for a lower-class family, especially one headed by a newly widowed woman, was extremely harsh in 19th-century England. The specter of being sent to a workhouse or being separated from her mother and brother cast dark shadows over Mary Ann's girlhood and was the cause of many nightmares. Mary Ann never went into the workhouse, however, because her mother remarried. Her new stepfather did not like Mary Ann, and the feeling was mutual. Mary Ann began looking for an escape from her childhood home, although she owed one thing to her stepfather. His salary had kept her and her family from becoming homeless and destitute. At an early age, Mary Ann learned to avoid the miserable fate of her nightmares, and she had to keep a steady flow of money coming her way, no matter what the method. Perhaps partly to escape the daily life with her stepfather, Mary Ann left home at the age of 16 to work as a servant in a prosperous household in South Hetton. Mary Ann's work quality caused no complaint, although she began what would become a life riddled with sexual scandals. Soon after Mary Ann began working in the household, the South Hetton gossips were busy spreading tales about illicit meetings between Mary Ann and a local churchman. After 3 years of service in South Hetton, Mary Ann left to train as a dressmaker and to marry a miner named William Mowbray, by whom she had become pregnant. After their wedding in July of 1852, the newlyweds moved around England as William got work at various mining sites and on railroad construction projects throughout England. In the first 4 years of their marriage, William and Mary Ann had 5 children, although 4 of them died in infancy or soon after. Even though child mortality rates were high at the time, this was a bit extreme. However, Mary Ann and William were probably viewed as particularly unlucky parents, suffering from grievous personal losses. Mary Ann and William did not have a happy marriage. They frequently argued about money, as Mary Ann was still obsessed about never becoming poor. The quarrels grew so heated that William, in an apparent attempt to get some peace, landed a job on the steamer Newburn out of Sunderland and was often away from home. Mary Ann and the surviving children followed him and took up residence in Sunderland, and the number of her children lost to indefinable illnesses continued at an alarming rate. In January of 1865, William returned to the house to nurse an injured foot, and Mary Ann helped him recover. Later that month, despite a doctor's care, William died from a sudden intestinal disorder, which he had not shown evidence of before benefiting from Mary Ann's care. Soon after William's death, the doctor went to the Mowbray house to console the grieving widow, but was surprised to find Mary Ann dancing around the room in a new dress she had bought with the money from William's life insurance. Soon after William Mowbray's death, Mary Ann moved her remaining children to Seaham Harbour, where she struck up a relationship with Joseph Natras, a local man who was engaged to another woman. Apparently unable to break up the engagement, Marianne left Siem Harbor after Natras's wedding and after burying her 3.5-year-old daughters, leaving her with one living child out of 9 she had given birth to. Natras would reappear in Marianne's life several years later. Marianne decided to return to Sunderland and found employment at the Sunderland Infirmary, House of Recovery for the Cure of Contagious Fever, Dispensary, and Humane Society. Her remaining child, Isabella, was sent to live with her maternal grandmother and would remain in her grandmother's care for more than 2 years. At the Sunderland Infirmary, Marianne kept the wards clean with a mixture of soap and arsenic, and the infirmary staff admired her diligence and friendliness with the patients. She chatted with many of them, but one in particular, engineer George Ward, took a fancy to Marianne. Soon after he was discharged from the infirmary, he and Marianne were married at a church in Monk Wearmouth in August of 1865. Although now settled into a new marriage and a steady household, Marianne did not fetch Isabella from her mother's house. Despite having been released from the infirmary, George Ward developed health problems soon after marrying Marianne. And despite various treatments by his doctors, he died in October of 1866 after a long bout of paralysis in his limbs and chronic stomach problems. The doctor attending George was accused of incorrectly treating his patient, a point of view that Marianne actively encouraged, probably hoping to redirect any doubts away from herself. Much later, at Marianne's trial, people would wonder why nobody became suspicious of this woman who left a trail of husbands and children dead from startlingly similar illnesses over a very short time. But as Marianne had different doctors attend to her dying family and frequently relocated, suspicions were never built in a single community. According to her pattern, after George Ward's death in Sunderland, Marianne needed to move on. Pallian shipwright James Robinson needed a housekeeper to care for his house and children after the death of his wife, Hannah. In November of 1866, Marianne applied for the position and was hired. 2 days before Christmas, the family's baby was interred after developing a gastric fever, perhaps not surprisingly. Overcome with the grief of his wife's recent death and then of his infant son, James turned to Marianne for solace and support. She provided comfort and apparently then some, as she was soon pregnant with Robinson's child. A new marriage seemed to be in the forecast, but Marianne was diverted in March of 1867 by her mother's sudden illness. Marianne returned to her mother's home to help nurse the elderly lady back to health. As always, one of Marianne's first tasks was to clean the house from top to bottom with soap and, her favorite cleaning additive, arsenic, of which she usually had an ample supply. By the time Marianne arrived, however, her mother was doing much better. Still, Marianne decided to stay and look after her anyway and visit her daughter Isabella, who was still living with her grandmother. Soon after being in Marianne's care, her mother began complaining of stomach pains and died only 9 days after Marianne's arrival. Returning to the Robinson household with her mother, young Isabella, who had enjoyed a life of good health while living away from Marianne, soon developed an incapacitating stomach ailment, as did two of Robinson's children, and all three were buried within 2 weeks of each other at the end of April. James Robinson must have grieved further over the loss of two more of his children, but apparently did not suspect any wrongdoing on Marianne's part. He put his mourning aside in time for his wedding to Marianne in early August, at which Marianne stated her surname as Mowbray. Apparently, her 14-month marriage to George Ward had slipped her mind. The couple's first child, Mary Isabella, was born in late November, but had succumbed to illness by the 1st of March of 1868. James now began to become suspicious of his new wife, not only by the frequency of deaths in the household since Marianne's arrival, but also by her constant requests for money and her pressing desire for him to ensure his life. Always punctual in his household finances, James was surprised when he received letters from his building society and his brother-in-law detailing debts Marianne had run up without his knowledge. He questioned his remaining children and found that their new stepmother had convinced them to pawn valuables from the house and give her the money. Enraged, he threw Marianne out of the house, and she left, taking their young daughter with her. In late 1869, after wandering the streets in a kind of life that Marianne had anxiously feared, Marianne and her daughter visited an acquaintance. During the course of the visit, Marianne asked her friend to watch the girl while she went out to mail a letter. Marianne never came back, and the daughter was returned to James on the first day of 1870. After weeks of desperate living, the year 1870 began well for Marianne. Her friend Margaret Cotton introduced her to her brother Frederick. Like James Robinson, Frederick was a recent widower and had lost two of his four children to early deaths. His sons, Frederick Jr. and Charles, were all that was left of his family. His sister acted as a mother substitute for the family. However, in late March, she died from an undetermined stomach ailment, which left the opportunity wide open for Marianne to console the grieving Frederick. In an echo of her relationship with James Robinson, she was soon pregnant with Frederick's child. In September of 1870, Marianne again signed the register as Marianne Mowbray, ignoring the fact that her surname was legally Robinson and that she was not divorced from James, who was very much alive. Marianne added bigamy to her growing list of crimes. She quickly set up housekeeping in Cotton's house and just as quickly ensured the lives of Frederick Cotton and his two sons. After giving birth to a son, Robert, in early 1871, Marianne learned that her former paramour, James Natress, was not married and lived in nearby West Auckland. Under some pretense, Marianne moved the family there, and she quickly rekindled the relationship with Natress and became less interested in Frederick Cotton. In December of 1871, Frederick died of gastric fever, and Joseph Natress soon became a lodger in the three-time widow Marianne's house. To keep her fears at bay and to keep money coming in, Marianne worked as a nurse to John Quick Manning, an excise officer recovering from smallpox. Marianne apparently saw Quick Manning as a better match than Natress and soon became pregnant by him. A marriage to Quick Manning was hindered by the presence of the remaining Cotton household, so Marianne apparently went to work quickly, and Frederick Jr. died in March of 1872, and the infant Robert soon after. Upon the death of her infant, Marianne stated that she did not want to bury the baby immediately because Joseph Natress had also become ill with gastric fever, and she would wait and handle both burials at once. Natress obligingly passed away soon after Robert, but not before revising his will to leave everything to Marianne. Only one of her husbands, James Robinson, had escaped a relationship with Marianne with his life. Other husbands, children, and most stepchildren had succumbed to gastric fever or stomach ailments, except for young Charles Cotton and Robinson's children. The Robinson children were safely away from Marianne's motherly care, but the insurance policy Marianne had taken out on Charles's life still waited to be collected. In late spring of 1872, Marianne sent Charles to a local chemist to purchase a small quantity of arsenic. The chemist refused to sell the poison to anyone under the age of 21, as was the law. Undeterred, Marianne asked a neighbor to purchase the substance, and in July, Charles died of gastric fever. But Marianne had either been in the West Auckland area too long, or the neighbors were more readily skeptical, because suspicions were immediately aroused in neighbors and physicians. The first person Marianne told about Charles's death was Thomas Riley, a minor government official that she had consulted previously about the possibility of sending Charles into a workhouse. Riley had said that it would only be possible if she went with him, which she declined. She told Riley that the boy was in the way of a marriage with Quick Manning and predicted that, "I won't be troubled long. He'll go like all the rest of the Cotton family." Riley said the boy appeared completely healthy, so he was surprised when Marianne stopped him only 5 days later to say that young Charles had died. Riley went to the village police officers and a doctor and outlined his growing suspicions. The doctor was similarly surprised to hear of the news, as he and his assistant had tended to Charles 5 times during the previous week and had detected nothing dire, let alone life-threatening, in the young boy. Riley convinced the doctor to delay writing a death certificate until he could look into the situation further. Instead of fetching the doctor after the boy's death, Marianne hurried to the insurance office to collect on Charles's policy. She learned that they would not issue the money until they had a death certificate, so she returned home to get the document from the doctor. Instead of receiving the certificate, Marianne received the startling news that she would not be receiving a signed death certificate until after a formal inquest was held. A brief inquest was held, and initial evidence did not indicate death by unnatural causes. Angry at Riley for initiating the investigation, Marianne told him that he could be responsible for Charles's burial costs. The young boy's internment would most likely not have been the end of the story, and Marianne would have gone on with her plan to marry Quick Manning and probably continue obtaining insurance monies from other gastric fever victims. But the local newspapers latched on to the story. They reported on the inquest and alluded to the neighborhood gossip that Marianne was an active poisoner. These reports fanned the fires of rumors and hearsay, and the feeling toward Marianne within West Auckland became bitter and suspicious. Quick Manning was appalled by this type of gossip about his intended and was apparently distressed enough to sever all connections with Marianne. Marianne began preparations to leave the area, although her friends warned her that it would look suspicious if she did. Unknown to her, however, suspicions were already building and were about to close in around her. A doctor from the inquiry had kept samples of Charles's stomach to test them later in his lab. He did so, and the samples tested positive for arsenic. The doctor went to the authorities, arrested Marianne, and ordered Charles's body to be exhumed and thoroughly tested. The body of Joseph Natress was also dug up. After six exhumations of other corpses, the elderly sexton of the church couldn't remember precisely where Natress was buried and tested positive for the presence of arsenic. There were debate and talk of further exhumations, but it was decided to proceed with the single murder charge of young Charles Cotton, although the trial was delayed until the delivery of the daughter, fathered by John Quick Manning. Her trial began in March of 1873. The prosecution brought forth numerous witnesses who testified about Marianne's purchases of arsenic, the long list of gastric fever victims in her past, and about her statements regarding Charles being an obstacle to her marrying Quick Manning. The defense claimed that Charles might have obtained the arsenic that killed him from inhaling loose airborne particles of arsenic used as a dye in the Cotton home's green wallpaper. The judge dismissed this theory, and the jury retired for only 90 minutes before finding Marianne guilty of the murder of Charles Cotton. Marianne continued to proclaim her innocence and wrote numerous letters to her friends and supporters. A letter to her estranged husband, James Robinson, asked him to bring her child and two stepchildren to visit her in prison. She went on to beg Robinson, "If you have one spark of kindness in you, get my life spared. You know yourself there has been most dreadful lies told about me. I must tell you, you are the cause of all my trouble. If you had not abandoned me, I was left to wander the streets with my baby in my arms, no place to lay my head." Robinson ignored her letter, so she wrote him again and asked him to visit her. Robinson sent his brother-in-law to the prison in his stead. Marianne was upset that Robinson did not come himself, but asked the man about the children and requested that a petition be circulated in her support. Petitions were eventually created and signed by Marianne's former employers, ministers, and other supporters. As her execution date neared, she was cheered by a letter from a couple who had adopted the infant she and Quick Manning had conceived. She replied to the letter, asking the couple to kiss my babe for me. On March 24, 1873, Marianne was led to the scaffold where the elderly hangman misjudged the logistics of the execution. So instead of dying quickly, Marianne struggled after the trapdoor was released, and it took at least 3 minutes for her to be slowly and painfully strangled by the noose. Chances are, some of Marianne's alleged victims died from natural causes or reasons other than poisoning by her hands. Later researchers of the case would estimate her victims as numbering anywhere from 15 to the full count of 21 people who died while living with or near Marianne. 10 of her children by various husbands, 3 of those husbands, 5 stepchildren, her mother, Cotton's sister Margaret, and her lover Natress. Theories of motive range from the collection of insurance money to the desire to rid herself of people that she felt were obstacles, or a combination of both. Because she maintained her innocence to the end, it will never be known for sure how many victims Marianne claimed in her endless quest for the money that made her feel secure. Her notoriety continues with her fame as Britain's first female serial killer and in a popular children's rhyme. Marianne Cotton. She's dead and she's rotten. She lies in her bed with her eyes wide open. Sing, sing, oh, what can I sing? Marianne Cotton is tied up with string. Where, up in the air. Selling black puddings, a penny a pair.